This is a presentation on Bhagavad Gita, not going verse by verse, but taking some of the important subject matters of Bhagavad Gita. So it may be interesting for people to just get the main ideas that are important for them in their lives. So therefore I've taken a few of these ideas out. I call it lessons in transformation. Why transformation is because everybody wants change, but we want good change. We want improvement. We particularly want to change ourselves, or we want to change our situation. So we want some sort of improvement. The problem, of course, is what is that actual improvement and how are we going to do it? These are two big problematic things. Yeah? So you see, yeah, I want better, but what better? What do you want better? So we go, okay, we want better house or better clothing or better health or like that. So we can just look for some material benefits, and we can get those things, but we're not actually happy when we get those things also. People sometimes are not so philosophical when they analyze what they really want. And they want something which is better, but don't quite know what it is. And then how to get it again is another problem. So most people spend their lives laboring hard, putting forth a lot of effort into getting some material things, and when at the end of life, when they've got all those things, and they figure out that that wasn't so satisfying after all, and what was the improvement they were after, they can't figure it out. There's a story of one man, American, I think his name is Sullivan. He had an accident. He was making a telephone call in a thunderstorm, lightning storm, and the lightning hit the wire. So he got electrocuted. I don't know how many volts, maybe 3,000 volts or whatever, how many volts go through there when the lightning hits. And it went through the telephone line and it went into the telephone thing, which melted in his hand and like this, and he got all burned up. So they took him to the hospital, and he was there for many months, actually, because he was all burned up, you know. But when he had that catastrophe, actually, something strange happened. And he didn't feel anything. And actually, he could see the ambulance come. He could see them putting his body into the ambulance, etc., like that. So in other words, he had an out-of-the-body experience at that time. And then, as he was going in the ambulance and he was looking at himself, then he started going into this other world, went through the tunnel, came out the other side. And then he had very prolonged experiences there when he was in the ambulance and in the hospital, some very, very detailed experiences there. But the thing he realized was when he suddenly entered this world and then he got his life review, quick life review, then he realized, it was all useless. I missed something. I spent all my life, because he was a successful businessman, and he had done so many things. He wasn't evil, he wasn't selfish or whatever like that. He was a normal person. And he had prospered in his business and everything. But then he realized, after he got out of his body and he was in this other place, when he saw the review of his life, and he said, I wasted my whole life. Something is missing here. Because I'm not the body at all, and this is all this. I'm looking at all the stuff that happened in my life, and I missed something. I didn't do the right thing somehow. So we go throughout life, and we get different things we're interested in, whatever. But what is it actually we really want? We don't really know. They're very confusing. And then how to get it? Also very confusing. So that's the position of most people in the material world. We want, definitely, we want some improvement, we want a progress, we want to elevate ourselves somehow or other, but how to do it and what's the goal? So that's why we have to go to some authority. So we have authorities in the modern world, people that write books. You can go to the bookstore and, you know, go on the internet and find all sorts of solutions of meaning of life and what to do, etc. Some of which are partially correct or whatever. But actually it's better to go to the traditional books, that is the scriptures, which have been handed down for thousands of years. And they've been approved over and over again in the past and up until the present time. So they're not simply a modern phenomena. At the same time, then it's something which is out of date. There's something which was traditionally passed on because it was valuable. And the most intelligent people of the day were reading these books and studying them and getting value out of them. It's not that everybody was even, not everybody could read, actually. And even if they could read, there were no books available because books were very rare also. They were written on palm leaf, little leaves. And, you know, maybe the king had a library and the books were in there. Yeah. Even in Bhaktivinoda his time, which was in the late 1800s, many of the scriptures of the Gaudiya Sampradaya were not available, like the Brahma Sutra commentary of Baladeva Jibhusan, or the even Chaitanya Charitamrita. Very difficult to get. Sandarbha is not available. And the only place he could find those were in the king's library in Puri, and nobody could go into the library. So you know, even at that time, there was nothing available. Previous to that, of course, then it was even less available because there were no printed books at all, and people were just, whoever had the books were either kings or very wealthy people, or, you know, temples maybe had these books. So not really available yet. Those who could get access to them were very intelligent people and highly qualified, and that they understood the value of these works, and they preserved them, and they handed them down century after century after century. So they had value in them. So these scriptures actually are perfect knowledge. So we accept their authority and what they say as being actually true, even if we cannot prove it scientifically, as I showed yesterday. You cannot prove soul or God by a material science because they are not subject to material logic or material instruments. So that's difficult. So we trust the authorities and we trust those scriptures. So in India we have the Vedic scriptures. This is of course a large category. The Vedas themselves refer to the four Vedas, the Rig Veda, Yajur Veda, Sam Veda, and Atharva Veda. And they're eternal, but compiled by Vedavyas just a little over 5,000 years ago. That's when Kali Yuga began, and that's when Krishna was present, about 5,000 years ago. So end of Dwapara Yuga and beginning of Kali Yuga. That's when the Vedas were compiled by Vedavyas and passed on and preserved. But they were there previously. He didn't write them. He simply preserved them and divided them into four sections. So therefore the knowledge is eternal. But because the knowledge was vast and a little bit difficult to understand, Vedavyas also wrote other works. He wrote Puranas, which includes Srimad Bhagavatam, which we read every day, and that's considered to be the summary of everything. And he also wrote one of these itihasas, long histories, called the Mahabharata. And in the Mahabharata, he also wrote the Bhagavad Gita, which is, Mahabharata is also very big, and therefore maybe not so attractive because it's so huge, but the Bhagavad Gita is quite short, and within that we get a summary of all the Vedic teachings, or whatever's in the Vedas, and whatever else in the Mahabharata and other Puranas is also in the Bhagavad Gita. So it provides a good summary for us of all the Vedic knowledge and the wisdom, and it deals with these topics. What is the actual goal of life, and how to attain that goal? So therefore it gives us an answer to the questions. The literal meaning of Bhagavad Gita means the song of Bhagavan, the song of the Supreme Lord. Gita means song, Bhagavat means Bhagavan, which means Supreme Lord, full of all wonderful qualities. So it is a text spoken by Krishna to his friend Arjuna. Like that. So this work has become famous. Modern scholars, of course, put a historical date on it, so they said maybe 200 BC or something like that. Or we'll say, no, it was actually 5,000 when Vyasa was present, 5,000 years ago, which is like 3,000 BC or whatever. But modern scholars say 200 BC or whatever. In any case, it's an ancient text. And it's well respected within India because it is concise, whereas the Vedas are very, large and maybe difficult to understand. It's an easier text to understand. So many of the authorities in ancient times began to use this book and to explain this book. So we have many commentaries by famous persons. Even Shankaracharya wrote one commentary. And then we have all the Vaishnavacharyas like Ramanujacharya and Madhvacharya writing commentaries. And we have two commentaries within our Sampradaya. That is one by Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur and one by Baladeva Vidyabhushan. So Prabhupada's commentary is based upon Baladeva's commentary. So, and of course other Sampradayas have also written commentaries as well. So it's quite a popular work. And if in India, if you mention Bhagavad Gita, everyone will say, yes, I know Bhagavad Gita. So they know the title at least. They may not know what's in it, but at least they know the title, Bhagavad Gita. Okay, holy book, whatever sacred book. And of course, not only that, some people actually do at least memorize the verses, some verses of Bhagavad Gita. So it is traditional that some children, when they're in school, like 5, 6, 7 years old, they'll memorize one chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Like chapter 15 or the short chapter. So take a short chapter and memorize the whole chapter in Sanskrit. So it has some familiarity with the people of India also. So as I said, it's a dialogue between Arjuna, who was one of the Pandavas, and the charioteer, who was Supreme Lord Krishna, who acted as his charioteer. And the setting is a war. It's set on the battlefield. And the first chapter of the Bhagavad Gita describes this war, the beginning of the war, where you have this two sides. Pandavas on one side with all of their army and troops, and the Kauravas on the other side with all of their troops. And before the battle begins, then Arjuna's gets very confused, and he's about to give up the battle and not fight. And in that position, when he's very confused, then he questions Krishna, asks him questions, and then he starts getting answers from Krishna. And that's what the Bhagavad Gita is, Krishna's answer to Arjuna's confusion. So that's the basic background. So actually this was a very complex war in one sense. On the other hand, it isn't in one sense. It's a fight between what we call good and evil. The Pandavas were supported by Krishna, who was Supreme Lord. So we have the devotees and Krishna on one side. And then we have the other part, the opponents. They were the people that didn't recognize Krishna as God. They didn't respect Krishna, didn't respect the Pandavas, the devotees at all. So now we used to call these verses demons. Those that don't respect God or the devotees or the demons. That was a typical fight between the devotees and the demons. We'll find that not only there, but we'll find that earlier in the Bhagavatam. We'll find Prahlad was a devotee, Hiranyakasipu was his father and a demon. So they have, the Lord fights on behalf of Prahlad in that fight. And we have battles between the devas and the demons throughout the Bhagavatam on different occasions. So the conflict within with between good and evil is a constant theme throughout the day of Brahma. We have all these wars happening between us. So not surprising we get a war here also. This war was a little bit different because this was a war between members of the same family, more or less. This just describes the family tree, so to speak, the genealogy. So they both were parts of the same family, ultimately. And that made it worse because Arjuna had to fight against his relatives, his cousins, and his grandfather. So this was rather painful for him. Why should I fight them? But Krishna said, you fight anyway. So it was a very complex fight because of all of the people involved. They were related to each other and whatever. As I said, the date is, you know, disputable, but they say maybe 5th century to 2nd century BC or whatever like that. That's modern scholars say that. So, as I said, it's been respected. This work has been respected. And we have this verse. Some attribute this to Shankaracharya, whether it's true or not, I don't know. But it's a very little, nice little summary of a longer poetic work. Ekam shastram devaki putra gitam, eko deva devaki putra eva, kamanyekam devaki putra seva, mantropyeko devaki putra nama. So this is a nice summary of the the value of the Bhagavad Gita. There is one scripture, the Bhagavad Gita. So therefore, this statement means that even if you don't read or understand all of the Vedas, if you could understand Bhagavad Gita, then you got the essence of knowledge, and you can practice spiritual life. And there is one Lord, Krishna alone. So there is always a controversy. Who is God, whatever. And that's around the world, who is God or what is God? That's a controversy. In India, it's also a controversy because people worship many gods. Many things are God to different people. And therefore we have many different temples with many different deities in them. So we have Durga temples, and we have Shiva temples, and then we have Vishnu temples and Krishna temples and Rama temples and Ganesh temples and Subramanian temples, that is Kartikeya temples, very common in South India, and we get other deities that we've never even heard of as well. In Bengal they got a smallpox deity temple. So we got all sorts of things in India, and Kali temples, of course, expansion of Durga and Bengal, especially Kali, very popular. So we got all sorts of temples of, and everyone says Supreme God, this is God, this is God. So who is God? The Bhagavad Gita also defines that, and of course based upon the Vedas and the Brahma Sutras, etc. So the conclusion is only one Supreme Lord, not many different Lords, one Supreme Lord, and that is Krishna. So he is the speaker of the Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad Gita means song or the work written by or spoken by Krishna, Bhagavan. So that Bhagavan or the Lord is Krishna. So that is stated in Bhagavad Gita. There is one action. So we're not just philosophers. We do activities. We don't just learn things in our head. We have to do something. So what is the action? We serve Krishna. So that's the definition of bhakti yoga. Bhakti yoga means we engage our senses and our mind in serving Krishna and cultivating a loving relationship with him. So one action, serving Krishna. Only bhakti yoga, nothing else. No other jnana yoga, astanga yoga, karma yoga, or anything else. You do bhakti yoga and you serve Krishna. There is one mantra with the name of Krishna. So mantra, there are many mantras, there are many devatas and many forms of the Lord, and they all have mantras. And the mantras are used to worship those forms, and each mantra is considered to have power. and the mantras are mentioned in scriptures. So you would chant the mantra of that deity, you invoke the mercy of that deity, and then you get results from that deity. Okay? So there are many, many different mantras, many for devatas, and also mantras for the Supreme Lord. So they're powerful combinations of words, which aren't actually spiritual words when they refer to the Supreme Lord. But they also require some qualification. So therefore, these mantras, usually you have to take diksha or initiation to get these mantras from a guru. And then you can chant these mantras and get the benedictions of Supreme Lord or Devata. However, there's an easier process. And that is, you don't have to take diksha or initiation, but you just chant the name of Krishna. And it's more powerful than any mantra. And of course, it's also the name of Krishna, who is the one Lord. So therefore, it's the ultimate worship. So therefore, in this statement here, when it says, there's one mantra, mantropi eko devaki putra nama, the name of Krishna, that's the mantra for the mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita. So this is just a summary of everything. So back to the setting. As I said, it's a battlefield. It doesn't look so suitable for a philosophical religious discussion. Usually we think that, you know, they have to be peaceful, etc. And here we have the armies gathering together, blowing their conch shells and their horns and beating their drums and yelling at each other, just about ready, full of hatred and whatever excitement, just about to fight each other. And Krishna and Arjuna having a nice philosophical discussion. So it sounds a little bit strange. But we can understand that the whole setting is a setting of conflict, and there's a whole, you can say, a whole section of the Mahabharata dealing with these armies and the description of the armies just before they fight. And then there's an elaborate section on all the violent actions of the war itself, which lasted for 18 days, and there's a detailed description every day of all the people getting killed and all the different battle maneuvers they went through, etc. So conflict is greatly emphasized. So that was a huge conflict, and it says 18 million people died in that conflict, fighting more or less. And if we examine the world, there are conflicts everywhere. Yes, it's not uncommon, in fact very common. We'll have personal conflicts between people, friends even. We have conflicts. We have conflicts in work. People in work and office have conflicts. We get conflicts between religions. Different religions have conflicts, quite common in ancient times in Europe and other places as well. We get conflicts between families. Two families will be fighting for centuries, you know, together at each other, like that. We have all sorts of conflicts, the conflicts between countries, etc. And we know that in the modern world, we have conflicts happening all the time around the world. So it is a feature of the human being. So, of course, we don't like conflict. It's a time of great tension and confusion. At the same time, maybe the benefit of that is that we get opportunities to learn, create, develop, and transform. It acts as that miserable circumstance acts as a stimulus for examining ourselves very deeply and asking questions. So as I said, we have conflict of values and personal, our family values, different countries are different values, religions, different things. If we get a little value from that, is that we can become introspective and ask about what is the actual truth. Well, what are we fighting over, and what is the actual truth behind this? Why do we have to fight? What is the best choice of action, fight or not fight or whatever? What result are we trying to get by this conflict or whatever? So usually people don't ask too deeply, and the conflict continues maybe for centuries even in some cases between countries. So But if we are a little more introspective, then we'll use that conflict as a platform for asking questions and getting answers. Yeah? So out of the conflict, we get some sort of response and some solution coming out of that. Very good. So in this case, Arjuna had a lot of confusion due to the conflict, and he started asking the things in confusion, and very fortunately he had Krishna, the Supreme Lord, to answer him and give a solution to his conflict. So that's why we can say the conflict was there. It brought out all these questions which were in Arjuna's mind, and then finally he got a solution. For in this case, in Arjuna's case, and with our case also, we have to be willing to shift our consciousness a little bit, shift our point of view a little bit, and in that way we can actually come to a solution to the problem of conflict. But more than that, we can actually answer these questions about, you know, how to transform, how to advance in life, how to get the best goal, how to achieve the best goal. So the first is to realize the power of the mind. Of course, that's not the first thing in the Bhagavad Gita. It's probably the second thing, but anyway, I'm just putting it in a little order here. So this is the first paradigm shift. We have to understand the mind is a very powerful instrument of the human being. It's actually the mind. The mind, of course, means everything, not just the physical brain, but intelligence, mind, consciousness, emotion, the whole conglomeration of things. Is what makes us superior to other animals. Eh? We can discriminate much more clearly, we can communicate, we can we have creative abilities in art and music, etc. Well, this belongs to the human mind, the human intelligence, etc. So it's a privilege of the human being, and the mind is very powerful. We can think of goals and we can achieve goals. We can visualize things. We can do abstract calculations, mathematics and things which are very abstract, which animals cannot do. We have different ways of expressing things, so this becomes poetry and literature, which animals cannot do. Basically, they have a few calls they can make, and that's it. So human beings can express things in very artistic ways. So it's all because of the mind. So very, very powerful. Unfortunately, we do not recognize the power of the mind. It is powerful, and it's actually so powerful it is pushing us in one direction that's not very good for us. At the same time, we can use the mind, and it can be very beneficial for us. So, the mind has the power to think and to concentrate, etc. And this will determine results and ultimately our future. So what you think of, you become. As said in Bhagavad Gita, what you think of when you die, you become that in your next lifetime. So the mind is so powerful, it produces your body for you, as in the case of Bharat. Thought of a deer. Why did he think of a deer when he was dying? Because he got very attached to the deer. The deer became his life and soul. He was so attached to it. And so when he died, he thought of the deer. That image of the deer formed his body, and he became a deer in his next lifetime. So the mind determines his body. So we have to be very careful what we think of. So that is actually a whole physical body got formed because of his mind. Of course, he said, well, that was next life or whatever. But same operates in this lifetime. Whatever you think of, you become in this lifetime also. Unfortunately, to do that requires control of the mind. And most people cannot control the mind. It wanders everywhere. So in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says one must deliver himself with the help of his mind, not degrade himself. The mind is the friend of the conditioned soul and the enemy as well. So it's the enemy when you don't control it. and it just goes wherever it wants to go, and you don't have any particular goal in mind, or you have an evil goal in mind. And you can deliver yourself with the help of the mind when you control the mind, and the goal is something which is prescribed by the scriptures. It's a guaranteed goal, and you have that goal in your mind defined by the scriptures, and you follow the process of the scriptures, and you concentrate on that, then you get advancement, you get elevated. In that sense, the mind is your friend. So a very powerful instrument we have, though we may not be using it properly. Yeah. So as I said, the mind is strong, but it can go off in the wrong direction. As a strong wind sweeps away a boat on the water, even one of the roaming senses on which the mind focuses can carry away a man's intelligence. Very easily the mind goes off this way and that way. We're not attentive. So this is mentioned directly in the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita. This is where the first chapter is not philosophical, it's just the setting of the war and the tension between the two armies. Then Arjuna begins to ask us questions, and Krishna begins to answer in the second chapter. So here in the second chapter itself, Krishna is mentioning about the importance of the mind, but how, as a human being, we neglect the mind. So we develop beliefs and thoughts and feelings and whatever, and then we do actions. We get some result, and then we start thinking, yeah, this is good, that's bad, or whatever like that. And get more feelings, and then more actions. And this is what we do all day long, basically. But what's wrong with this is the beliefs and the thoughts and whatever, based upon the input for us, is not very well, ordered, not disciplined, and we don't make a decision based upon proper facts. But most of it is based upon feelings, like and dislike. Not upon values, but upon feelings. And then we do actions, and then we continue to do our actions based upon feelings in this world. And this creates a lot of problems for us. So in other words, emotions rather than intelligence determines our action, all that's happening in the mind. So this is one point. Mind is very important. Then we have to start controlling it and whatever. To do, the best way is we follow the directives of Scripture to do that. Yeah. So the important thing about the mind is ultimately it leads to action. But then action also is very important, because you have to have responsibility in the action. And again, it goes back to the mind again. So we do action, and that's related to responsibility. So that's the second thing we have to learn, responsibility. We have desires, we want to fulfill our desires, we do actions, but we have to be responsible for our actions. So this is the human being, not the animal. They don't have to be responsible. The human being, because he has power of mind, intelligence, he gets responsibility. Small children don't, but when you're grown up, you do. Because you have the power of your mind matured, so therefore the responsibility is there. So we are responsible for the actions and the results. Now we can say, well, of course, I recognize I do something, I get the result, fine, I can claim the result for myself. But what is the quality of the action to get the result you wanted? That will create a long-term result for you, which we call karma. You're responsible for that also. So you're not just responsible for the immediate, I work and I get my money. You're also responsible for the long-term result of your actions. Now we generally don't want to do that. Put the responsibility on somebody else. I'm not responsible for this action or whatever, or the result of this action. But the law of karma ensures that you are. So it's an inevitable law, an invisible law of the material world, that always operates for the human being throughout an individual's life. Every single action you do every day of your life gets karma. Okay? So you do an action which produces undue suffering on other living entities, then you have to suffer in your future lives. If you do actions which produce benefit for others, then you get benefit in other lives. So you get some automatic happiness. So that's the basic law of karma. We cause suffering to others, then we get the same suffering back on ourselves. We do benefit to others, we get the benefit back on ourselves. It's a very just law. It's like the law of the country, except this extends over many lifetimes and it invisibly acts. There's no policeman there, visible policeman, to throw you in jail or whatever. Eh? But the law of karma acts and you get your punishment anyway in terms of suffering or whatever. And it may extend over many lifetimes also. So it's an invisible law and it's a just law also. Whatever you do, you get it back on yourself. You do cruel acts, you get some cruel acts back on yourself. Very, very simple formula. And nobody can escape it. You may escape the government. You can hide your criminal activities and get away with it for a long time. But you cannot hide from the law of karma. It will get you in the end. I was reading, there was one man in America. They discovered he committed maybe 50 murders or something over the last 20 years. And they didn't actually know it. He was in jail for something. And then he confessed, well, I murdered this person, that person, that blah, blah, blah. And they didn't even know about it. He got away with all these murders. And then he confessed, and then they went investigating, and they found, the body's here, the body's here. So they found him, he only confessed, so they got him. So the government may not catch you for all of your sinful activities, and sometimes they're not even sin in the law of the country, you know. Killing animals is not a sin, so before that. But the law of karma is going to catch you in the end for all the suffering you cause in the material world to other living entities. Inevitable. Okay? So what is that for? To make us responsible for our activity. Beware when you do the activity. Think very carefully. Okay? What is the result on the world? Not just on yourself, but for the whole world. So that's the law of karma. Very important. We have to think very carefully what we do. To help us in that regard, we do have what is called a list of sinful activities and a list of punyas, good activities you can do. That gives us some sort of guideline about what to avoid and what to do. So these are in the scriptures. So it gives us some good guideline. We don't have to speculate on our own. And some of the rules are the same as the government rules. Some are more detailed than that. So we have to follow those rules, then we get good results. So responsibility means, with knowledge, we act. So if we act considering the advice of Scripture, then we're safe. And that makes us more responsible persons. Less violence in the world. When we're acting also, we do have to set a correct goal. This is also something that comes out of the mind again, like the responsibility and action itself. It comes out of the mind. And setting a goal for all your actions also comes out of the mind. So mind is very, very powerful. And if you set your goals, then you can attain the goals. If you don't have any goals, you don't attain anything. So unfortunately, people don't know what the goal is and they set the wrong goals. Or they set goals which are full of bad karmas, so they have to suffer for that. So somehow we have to choose the correct goal. Of course, there are many types of goals, and generally people in this world have material goals. They set their mind on certain things, they do activities, they get their results. And if they have a strong mind, then they get better results. If they have a weak mind, don't concentrate, they don't get much. And some people are so undeveloped that they don't even have any goals. They're just sitting there and that's it. Those with a little more advanced have a goal and they try to achieve it somehow or other. Those who have stronger minds have more precise goals, and they work very hard to get those goals, and they find all sorts of means to get those goals, so they get better achievements. So mind is very, very important in achieving these goals. Unfortunately, we got too many goals, and we get a little confused. Yeah? That was also there in ancient times, so basically they classified them artha, dharma, kama, and then moksha. They just give you four goals, and most people concentrated on the first three. Yeah? Well, now we get so much complexity in the world. Yeah? So many types of goals are available to you in all different categories. So we get educational goals, we get career goals, and that we've got so many choices you can there, like infinite number of choice of jobs you can get, and types of education. Then we have financial goals, how much money you want to make. Different people are differently ambitious in that regard. We got family goals, how to raise a family, etc., how many children you want, etc. Then we have physical goals, health, what I want to do. And we got the public service goals in some cases. We get artistic goals, and we get pleasure goals, what I want to do in my spare time, recreation, etc. Those are common things in the material world. And just, you know, there's infinite number of things you can get as your goal in the modern world. Everything becomes very, very complex, the choices. You just go to a store and buy a cell phone, and then there's so many varieties there, you don't know which one to choose. There's so many things, and you get all confused about choosing a little phone just to so you can talk to somebody. And so, well, we get so many choices there in the material world now. It's very, very confusing. Yeah? So, and everything to get these things, then you have to get money. To get the money, you have to work, and set. So it's very complex how to get your goal fulfilled there. And unfortunately, everything is impermanent. All these goals are subject to loss. You may lose them in this lifetime, or you may lose them when you die. In any case, when you die, you have to lose everything. So the family and society and friends and money and success and fame all finished when you die. So it's a big disappointment. So that's why I told you that story of the man that was electrocuted, and then when he was having his life review, then he realized, it's all useless. I did all this my life, and it's nothing. I'm not this at all. It's useless. Yeah? And as Bhagavad Gita says, dukkhalaya masasvatam, the whole world is a place of misery, and it's very impermanent. Nothing lasts here. So all the goals that we set ultimately are useless. So many people don't realize that, and they throughout their life they're striving like that, and then they die, and then they realize when they're dead, it's all gone. And they become very miserable in their old age because they realize it's all gone, finished. Yeah. So some people will be a little bit before death, they will be a little more inquisitive, and they'll understand that, yeah, this is not so good. There must be some other purpose in life, some permanent goal, some more satisfying thing. That's a fortunate person. And they may ask it early in life. It's even more fortunate. If they ask it when they're dying, then it's a little bit too late. Yeah? So better we ask when we're young. Yeah. So ultimately, it's the goal is actually perfect happiness. All these things, you're trying to be happy through all these different things. This is where we get our happiness. This will make me happy. But none of these things are permanent. They're not going to be really satisfying. So, you know, we set the goal, but it's going in the wrong direction. So, therefore, we come to the more elevated goal, and that's a real big shift out of the material world. This is the moksha goal, artha, dharma, kama, then we get to moksha. This is the fourth shift. I'm not the body. I am the atma. I am the soul. I am eternal. This is me, not the body. So this is a big shift that one has to make, away from taking this as valuable and shifting to another thing. The Atma is about, the spirit is valuable, not this material world. It's, of course, very easy to see. The body dies. We know that. But to understand that the soul is there and that goes on, that's more difficult for people to understand. So that's, again, a very basic principle enunciated in the second chapter, again, of Bhagavad Gita. In fact, the first teaching of Krishna to Arjuna, you're a fool because you're lamenting for your body. You're not the body. First teaching is this very basic teaching which most people have difficulty understanding, and even religions have difficulty understanding the difference between body and soul. That's a very basic thing we have to understand if we want to get satisfaction. And so matter is very different from soul. Body is made of matter. Matter is unconsciousness, lifeless, is temporary, subject to decay. We can lose things all the time. We get sickness, old age, and death. Obvious. These are obvious things. And everybody gets attached to these things. But actually useless. So ultimately, the Atma or the soul or the Jiva is actually you. It's conscious. It knows things, performs action, experiences joy. It's eternal, without change or death, beyond time and space. So it's opposite of everything in the material world. And it's actually who you are. So to understand the difference between body and soul is the first step in spiritual life. And this is the first, we can say, the first goal we should have. Not the goals in the material world, but the mind should be used to get this goal. Understand that we're not the body, we're the soul. And, of course, then we have different processes mentioned in Bhagavad Gita to free the Atma from the body. One is Jnana Yoga, one is Astanga Yoga. And if you do free the body from the soul from the body, then no more fear of death, no more fear of the future, no attachment to material acquisition or reputation, your freedom from desire and hatred, freedom from thinking of friends and enemies and all these sorts of dualities in the material world, freedom from conflict, all disappear. So it's a very good goal. And you become very peaceful, get satisfaction, you understand this is the truth. It's the actual truth, eternal existence, sat. But that's not that conclusion. Not some people get that far and say, that's it. We're not the body. We're something eternal, finished. No. Very clear in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna makes the point, there is Supreme Lord Krishna, the Supreme Atma. We have the individual Atmas, many, and then we have one Supreme Lord. As we saw in the very beginning, there was one Supreme Lord, Krishna. So there's one Absolute Lord, and we have many, many Jivas. So this is important for the Jiva because this makes the Jiva not simply one thing kind of existing in eternity, but he's not alone. The Supreme Lord is there. And the nature of the Supreme Lord is he's the friend of the individual Atma. He's the protector, he's the guide for the Jiva in the material world. So in other words, we got a little help to realize our situation here and get out of this material world and attain our happiness. So in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna states that he's the protector of all beings, which means that he nourishes them, he encourages them, he helps them in all ways. He acts as the friend and advisor of Arjuna. The whole Bhagavad Gita is based on the fact that Krishna says, I'm teaching to this because you're my friend. And actually he acted as the advisor. At the same time he acted as the servant because he was driving the chariot of Arjuna. So he was a very good friend, that he would even serve Arjuna even though he's Supreme Lord. So the friend acts as a very intimate friend of each individual. And he's the perfect object of love. He has perfect beauty, which is all spiritual, not material. Therefore, it does not decay. And beauty is defined in the nectar devotion as all the bodily parts are in a perfect arrangement, perfect proportion, in the perfect place in his body. And they're all eternal. Not only does he have the beauty aspect of his body, but he's full of all wonderful qualities that are most attractive. Okay? So there, that makes him the perfect object of love. The problem in the material world, we want to love, but the object is not perfect. And so we end up with a lot of problems. We end up with disappointments because of that. But here's the perfect object of love. And he responds perfectly to each individual. And therefore, one is completely satisfied. And not just one jiva, many, 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 many jivas. So we have a whole community of big festival, big party there, represented by the Ras Leela, in which there were 3 billion gopis and 3 billion Krishnas dancing together all night, or for the night of Brahma. So in other words, the ultimate goal of the jiva is not just realize the Lord, but you can only realize him by having a relationship with him. Yeah? So ultimate goal is that realizing the relationship with the Lord. What is that relationship? It's a relationship of love, pure love, which we call prema. And in that, there's an exchange. It's not one way, just the Lord or the jiva. It's an exchange. It's a reciprocation between Supreme Lord and the individual soul. And both are spiritual, and they exchange in such a way with great intimacy, so that bliss arises. So in chapter 9, Krishna says that I am in you and you are in me. In other words, there's a very intimate relationship there, and it creates the highest bliss for the jiva and for Krishna. So in our temple, we have form of Krishna, and we have Radharani, who is the best devotee. So this represents the highest bliss between the devotee and the Supreme Lord. Highest bliss possible. So that's the goal of the jiva. That's the goal of the each individual atma, how to be happy. And that is represented by Radha and Krishna here. So how do we get to that goal? We can use the mind. Of course, through the mind, we will go to use our intelligence, and we'll go to the scriptures. I said, scripture gives us perfect knowledge. So from the scriptures, we get a perfect means of getting to the Supreme Lord. So the general means is the same as the goal, actually, expressing love, what we call sadhana or practice. So we're practicing how to love Krishna in sadhana bhakti. And to do that, we have to use our intelligence, go to the scripture, and apply our mind. We have to concentrate on going in this direction instead of going into the material world, not get distracted by material things. To help us, then we have the mantra. Mantra means to deliver the mind. And we saw the mind is the enemy and the mind is the friend. If the mind gets distracted onto material things, it becomes the enemy. If it's concentrated on the material, on the spiritual, then it's your friend. You're going to advance. And the best thing is being prema with Krishna. So the mantra helps do that. It helps us concentrate on Krishna and love of Krishna. So this is why we chant the Maha Mantra, the great mantra, Hare Krishna. It is the name of Krishna. We saw that this mantra was actually the greatest mantra in that first verse I quoted. One mantra, name of Krishna. So therefore, how to free the mind, how to deliver the mind, you chant the name of Krishna. That's the highest thing. It's got the name, it's the highest form of the Lord, Krishna. And this will deliver us, that will help us concentrate our mind so that we can attain the goal. Okay. So that's the summary of some of the main points of the Bhagavad Gita. So everything is, all the Vedic scriptures are summarized in the Bhagavad Gita, and ultimately, though there are many different forms of the Lord, ultimate form is Krishna as stated here. And what is the action? Bhakti yoga, serving Krishna. And in that, what is the process? Chanting the Maha Mantra, name of Krishna, Nam Sankirtan. So that's basically where the Gita is going, to give us that highest goal of prema and bliss. Okay. Any question?
Earlier on you mentioned on the Bell of Correct Sections, like 10 million died. Do you know where that figure comes from?
I don't know. Yeah, I heard it quoted everywhere. I think Prabhupada also said that someplace, but I don't know. Maybe they estimate the number of Akshauhini things who were there, and it's a certain specific number of troops in that. So many elephants, so many foot soldiers, etc., etc. So then they add up all those and they get maybe 18 million.
Oh, really? If you're doing that, it's just under
4
million.
Oh, it is? Really?
Yeah, I don't know. I personally heard Prabhupada in the lecture say 160 million.
Oh, okay.
I was just interested where the 18 comes from.
I don't know. I just heard it. This.
One version of Mahabharata is over a billion, so...
Oh, okay. I think 42 million died in First and Second World Wars. But not all, that was not all conflict. It was due to disease also.
Maharaj, I always find it difficult to convince people that are applying the principle of Bhagavad Gita in their lives about Krishna consciousness. And the principle I'm talking about is that setting goals, because when someone sets a goal in their life, they strive for it, like you said, utilizing their mind, they get a sense of satisfaction, they derive a sense of satisfaction, which is ever increasing. And those people, they're very difficult because they're the ones, they're like the big Vaishnavas or the guys that are really together and they're like, they're just, you know, the one with the goal. And I found it very difficult to convince because they are applying principles of Bhagavad Gita, namely they utilize their mind, they control the senses to the extent that they will even, to some extent, ignore their family or not ignore what I'm saying. That's, you know, it's not the prime thing. And they strive for their goal, whatever that may be. And generally it's a good one, because they have such a power of mind. And therefore they apply the principles of Bhagavad Gita that Krishna teaches to Arjuna. But you try to convince them to slightly turn that goal and do it for Krishna, and I find it very difficult because the reason for that is that they derive a sense of satisfaction from achievement, sense of achievement.
Okay.
That sense of achievement is so powerful that and it's a very crazy that to knock them off that podium to say, okay, or not, I think directly towards Krishna.
That's the rajasic influence, they want to set their goals and achieve their goals and they feel I did it. So that's there, but even that is not perfect because they can set their goals and achieve them, but it ultimately isn't satisfying. But only when they die they'll realize that, because they have to leave it all, then they'll be very dissatisfied. But you know, if you're more intelligent, you realize before that it's a thing. So therefore, a real intelligent person, even if he's in a Vaishya or whatever, and interested in his goals, etc., realize you have to have a little bit of everything. So you also have to have that other goal, the spiritual goal, along with that. So that's a higher consciousness.
How do you catch it before they die? Because that's the point you said.
Yeah, well, I'm saying better if they could, before they die, also include that bhakti in there, because that's what Krishna is saying in Bhagavad Gita ultimately, that you know these other things are useless and therefore go for the higher goal. So with the same dedication that they're trying to get their material goals, they should also make achieving the Lord as another goal, and they'll get permanent satisfaction that way. But some people don't have that belief, they don't have that faith, so what can we do about it? You know, they need a constant association of devotees, give them more prasadam or something, and eventually they get a little faith and, you know, Krishna does exist and whatever, and then they'll get that goal also, but it may take time.
It's like the yogis there. I mean, we don't deal so much with the yogis. We deal more with businessmen, people that are achieving things. But in a sense, the yogis, they're also like that. They get the mystic power, they get more excited about it.
Yeah, same thing.
They just don't worry about Krishna. gain something from it, which is very satisfying.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the whole lure of what karma kanda and karma yoga. You get stuck there, getting your svarga loka or whatever, or brahma loka or whatever, and you're satisfied with that, and you get conditioned by that enjoyment, whether it's rajasic or sattvic enjoyment. You know, so that's the downfall of just limiting yourself that far. But it's one step also if they follow dharma to do it. If they follow the dharma, at least they're following the first step. From that, then they got to go higher. Of course, in the original Varnashram system, it was inbuilt. After you attain, then you got to renounce. Become a vanaprastha. Vaishya kshatriyas and brahmanas should become vanaprasthas at 50 years old. They shouldn't go on until they're 90 years old trying to accrue more. So it was some sort of a reminder that they had to start renouncing.
Because nowadays
they get so excited, instead of renouncing, they go to teach other people how you do it. Maharaj, you spoke a lot about controlling the mind, power of the mind. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit on the placebo effect they're studying these days, of like because you believe something, you can cause a great effect in your body or in your surroundings like this. That shows that actually, mind over matter is actually being proven in science now.
Yeah.
People actually cure themselves from diseases, all these things.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So you think that's going to become more of a means, less relying on chemicals and stuff, but more relying on our minds?
Well, on the sattvic level, if they get to that level, then science can appreciate that. And if they get actual, they can prove it physically, by experiments or whatever, that it does work, fine, it's a one level of advancement. Of course, we can also explain that somewhat in the material world, because it's a subtle body, which is also material, so we're not just the gross physical body, which put liquid chemicals in there and alter things. There's a more complex body there, the subtle body, on several layers as well, and it's a little more delicate, we can say it's part of the mind in one sense. So you alter that mind a little bit, then you can get your cure that way. And so, in other words, the mind over matter is there because your subtle body is there, and that subtle body is also influencing this body. So if we control the mind, and we control the subtle body, we get the subtle body acting properly, then we can cure yourself, like that. There's one man, what is his name? Dispenza, Joe Dispenza. So he had an accident, and he got a back spinal problem, and he broke his spine or something, or something very serious. So he was threatened with just being in a cast all of his life, or more like that. And then they said the only solution is you've got to have this operation, which is quite dangerous actually to do, because the risk is they do the wrong thing, then he's paralyzed for life, so I don't want to do that. So he decided, well, I'll try the mind process. So then he meditated very intensely on each little bone in the back of his spine getting repaired. And he did this for a year, every day he would meditate on the correction of his spinal bones, etc. Which doesn't look possible, because how is the mind going to influence a bone? But after 1 year he did get cured. But it was like an intense process. He had to really concentrate and concentrate and concentrate, like anything for over a year. And then finally it healed. The whole thing healed. And he was perfect after that. He could walk perfectly and everything. So it was without using, modern, operation or anything, or surgery, whatever. And just did it through the mind. So it is possible. It may take great effort.
My second question is, you're speaking about different things lead to action. Mostly it's just by feeling. So this feels good, that feels good. And then you were saying emotions, it's going to use your intelligence, not just your emotions. Mm. And then we also have this term in psychology of emotional intelligence, where you know, you can just be like logically intelligent, but you're not like sensitive or like in touch with your
emotions.
Yeah, yeah. It's actually considered like something.
Yeah, when I talk about intelligence, I don't mean it's a logical left-brain intelligence. I don't mean that. One is, of course, your intuition intelligence, or moral intelligence, or ethical intelligence, which is a little finer, or your scriptural intelligence, that you understand what scripture means, and therefore you go by the scriptural guidelines. So even if you don't have your intuitional intelligence developed enough, at least you go by scripture, and you're willing to submit the mind and your desires and all your emotions to the scriptural guidelines, you know, which is difficult for many people to do, but if you can do it, fine, you know. So therefore when I talk about the intelligence, doesn't mean just logical intelligence, but something a little more like inspirational. We can say ultimately coming from the soul, ultimately in Paramatma, maybe we can say, you know.
We hear from the Acharyas and see within the scriptures the troubles that lie within the material world. The detail, when understood, one can drive through these troubles very nicely. But when troubles arise within the material world, like those now, like COVID-19, 5G, you see some getting completely digested by these topics, which cause so much distress. How can we as devotees keep the main thing, while dealing with these troubles around us with intelligence and so forth?
Well, like anything in the material world, our bodies are also affected by everything, affected by disease or whatever, accidents. So we do have to use our intelligence to protect our body for Krishna. We can't just say, okay, Krishna's in charge, we'll just walk out in the middle of the street without looking if the cars are coming down the street or not. So, same way, we also have to use our intelligence to look after our body and see that we don't get sick or whatever. Therefore, we have to follow some rules like that, so we don't get sick or give other people the sickness or whatever. So we have to use that much intelligence. At the same time, we're a little bit detached. We should be a little detached from the body, because body is temporary, and if it's the will of Krishna, then whenever we die, whatever, and we don't limit too much for that. But as long as we do have the body, we try to protect it as much for Krishna's service. So that much we have to, you know, use our intelligence to handle the situation in the material world.
In the last lila, there were 3 billion bodies, right?
There were what? 3?
Billion.
3 billion gopis.
Yeah, that's what Vishnu Chakravarti says. 3 billion. Yes, they fit in one little forest, and it was all secret, and nobody knew about it. And there were 3 billion Krishnas, because he expanded for each gopi, and they were in a big circle also. I'm calculating, I don't know how many, 6 billion people in a big circle. How much area that will take up? Pretty big area, but. Somehow, they were able to fit one little forest in Vrindavan and had a good time. And each gopi thought, Krishna's only with me also. So that's Krishna's spiritual potency, Shakti.
So I understand that Krishna would be 3 billion or 10,000 millions. But my question is, were all the gopis from the small village of Vrindavan?
Yeah. Well, even in Vrindavan, the number of cowherd boys and calves is some astronomical number. I don't know how many billions that is. Also, when Krishna goes out in the field, he's got all these cowherd boys and billions of cows and calves there going out in the field every day.
But that would make someone think that this is either like a fairy tale or...
Well, it's a spiritual world, actually. So it's unlimited. Yes, not even materials. Yeah, yeah. So it's not confined to physical space at all.
Or time.
Or time. Yeah.
Just in regards to what we were saying about like the billion. one to, you know, for example, the idea of self in the spinal injury. So that same sort of principle obviously applies to our bhakti as well. Like we could almost, I suppose that's why the Buddha bhakti, the ability to meditate on something, and you know, you can heal your spine to be able to reach, to walk again, you could almost meditate on prema and bring it to life.
Well, that's our whole process. Meditate on your spiritual body and serve Krishna. That then you enter into that pastime and you're there.
So that's kind of like Raghunuga Bhakti.
Well, even in Vaidhi Bhakti, the same things apply. You're still using your mind also there. And always remember Krishna, never forget him. Yeah? So we're trying to remember Krishna there as well. So either way, that's just a more spontaneous way of doing it and related particularly to Krishna and Vrindavan with particular rasa. But even if you don't do that, somehow if you concentrate on Krishna anyway, then that's what you attain. Yeah. So it's like Bharat attained a deer body by meditating on a deer, but meditate on Krishna, we attain Krishna. But it may take us several lifetimes because, you know, he's a spiritual body, etc., and we have to fully concentrate with prema, with full love and no material desires. It may take a few lifetimes to do that.
In relation to that question, you were saying before that bhakti is completely independent.
Mm-hmm.
So we can't, could we say that like that idea of the placebo, if you just think about it, it will manifest. That's kind of saying within our power to attain the bhakti, whereas the bhakti, like Krishna gives it.
So in the definition of sadhana bhakti is engage your senses and mind. Now they will say, well, that's material. But what makes it spiritual is the fact that we have faith and a little attraction to Krishna, and that's the Krishna Anusilanam, which is the basis of engaging your senses. So the motivation of engaging your so-called material senses is that little bit of bhakti we have, and of course if you go on it's more bhakti. So that transforms the senses and the mind. They're no longer acting materially at that point. So in other words, we switch from material to spiritual. And then that helps us develop our spiritual mind. So eventually when you get to bhava, then your spiritual mind is quite activated with Hladini and Sambit. Okay. Hare Krishna.